Here is another story I have heard. One of the council of the directions whose fields bordered on the silent forest heard a baby cry as he inspected his herd. He knew he should ignore it, but he was, the story says, a soft-hearted man and a curious one. So he looked over the fence that kept his cattle from wandering into the forest, and there, just under the trees, in among the bulge-eyed stakes that marked the boundary between the forest and the territory of humans, lay two tiny, just-born babies. There was a time when such was the fate of any twins born in Iriden, any whose status as twins could not be concealed in some way, at any rate. Why the god of the silent might have taken so against twins, I do not entirely understand. It was not the sort of thing the forest often concerned itself with. Indeed, the forest rarely concerned itself with anything outside its trees that did not directly affect it. It may be that the god had little or nothing to do with the matter. It was perhaps already a custom of the Iridani for some reason, or it suited some mother of the silent to say the forest had issued such instructions. I don't doubt that if such was the case, the forest would not have seen any reason to protest. After all, the babies were left as offerings for it. Whatever the reason for the practice, for long centuries in Iriden, twins were left at the edge of the forest to die. It was popularly imagined that people wandering unwary into the forest without the god's permission, off the road, past those staked offerings, would be pursued and devoured by the ghosts of those thousands of long-dead twins. But this had changed some years back. There were various accounts of why or how it had changed. A pair of twins had been instrumental in saving the forest or one of its favourites from some indignity, or someone the god of the silent cared for or had made some promise to, had borne a pair of twins, and the god found itself in a quandary. The Raven of Iriden featured in quite a few of these stories, as it happens. Vastai was one of the few places in Iriden where one might actually meet twins, or at least twins openly acknowledged as such, though even there they were looked at with some dread. And still, anywhere in Iriden, a person who gave birth to twins would be looked at with some suspicion that they might have done something to bring such a misfortune on themselves. A member of the Silent, discovered to have given birth to twins, would be expelled. The counsellor of the directions had, of course, been to Vastai quite a lot, so perhaps he was used to the idea of twins not being immediately banished to the forest, and felt bad for the babies. Perhaps he hoped to find whoever it was who had given birth so that he could convey that information to the local mother of the Silent to help prevent, or at least minimise, any potential sacrilege. Or, as some gossip at the time suggested, perhaps he was himself the twins' father, or grandfather, and wished to preserve the lives of the twins without implicating his lover or his child. Whatever his reasons, he retrieved the twins from the forest, sacrificed a heifer in their place, as had become expensively customary, and sent them to Vastai, where they were given the names Askel and Arkim, and they grew up in the fortress. While you were atop the Raven Tower, Askel and Arkim arrived in Vastai. They had been sent for. They would not otherwise have left Ardvusthia. There was no history of twin sacrifice in Ardvusthia, though it wasn't that the gods of Ardvusthia, or the gods of the north for that matter, had never taken human lives as offerings. On the contrary. But human sacrifice there had never taken that particular form. So I suppose Ardvusthia was more comfortable for them. But also, no boat would take them across the strait without a token from the lease authorising their crossing, despite the fact that any Iridani might cross without such a token. This sort of thing may be why they grew up to be the sort of people that they were. You passed them on the stairs as you came down from your audience with Hibal and Radihor. Do you remember them? Two men, their faces near identical, their beards trimmed close, their hair cut short, each with the same slightly sullen expression, each wearing a new cloak of undyed wool, fastened with a bronze pin, one in the shape of a raven, one shaped like an oak leaf. No more gold on them than you wore. Askel had a cuff of it around one wrist, Akim a heavy gold ring on a finger of his right hand. In fact, they were reasonably wealthy. Askel worked for the official tasked with collecting duties from ships traversing the strait, and it would take a naive man indeed, or a very honest one, to hold such a position without finding some way to enrich himself. His brother Akim had shares in several ships and their cargoes. You can imagine, I'm sure, what an advantage it would be to him to have Askel as a brother. They could have well afforded to dress better on being summoned to Vastai, but I imagine they were both canny enough to see the dangers of looking too well off when appearing before the Raven's Lease. As you passed them on the stairs, I think you noticed, or at least suspected, what they were, by the sudden small twitch of your eyebrow, the tightening of your already tense shoulders, the almost imperceptible movement of your left hand as you stopped yourself from making that gesture you had made earlier atop the tower. You hid it well, but Askel and Akim had seen such looks and that gesture all their lives. I am sure they noted your reaction as they continued up the stairs. You came out of the fortress gate, only glancing over at Mawat, still sitting there, naked and shivering. At least now he sat on the blanket you had brought him, and not on the bare stones. It was late enough in the day that the square was full of people coming and going, and I thought you wanted to go over to him and tell him what you had just seen, but you must have had some misgivings about being overheard, and you walked by without speaking to him. He clearly noticed you as you passed, but did not call you over or make any sign that he wanted to speak to you, though there was curiosity in his expression. He had seen you brought to the fortress, and doubtless wished to know what had happened. You went into the guest house up to your room, sat first on your bed, but not for long. Soon you stood and paced the small space, frowning, stopping occasionally to stare at one plain plastered wall, and then pacing again. After 15 or 20 minutes of this, you left your room again, strode down the stairs and out into the square, and halted, seeing Askel and Akim standing beside Mawat, speaking to him, smiling and friendly. Mawat was not smiling, but he was speaking to them, apparently without excessive rancour. You watched this. What did you think about it? What did you feel? Were you frightened, disconcerted, angry, worried? Perhaps all of those. For a few moments you watched Mawat, still looking up as the twins spoke to him. Then you walked over to where they stood, where Mawat sat.
"Eolo," he cried as you came up. "Meet my childhood friends, Askel and Akim. They've been over in Ardvuthnia for several years now, but they've come back to Vastai out of concern for my well-being, they tell me." Askel and Akim had never been Mawat's friends, excepting that time they had all been too young to understand much at all, let alone have reasons to resent each other.
"Lords,"
you said, and inclined your head. Askel stared at you. Akim smirked.
"Indeed, Lord," said Askel, looking away from you toward Mawat again. "We had no other reason to come."
"None at all?" asked Mawat, seemingly sardonically amused. "I'm touched. You're both of you a credit to whoever bore you." Your eyes widened to hear Mawat speak so. I knew you suspected Askel and Akim to be twins, and had perhaps resolved to pretend you hadn't noticed, didn't realize it. And it would have been disconcerting enough if either Askel or Akim had admitted it plainly. But here, Mawat was, throwing it in their faces that their birth had been a disgraceful thing. Akim scowled. Askel's expression barely changed.
"Indeed, Lord Mawat, we've missed you and your graciousness towards our undeserving selves." Just a hint of malice in his voice,
but he did not dare to take obvious offence. "Good Aeolo, perhaps you'll find your lord and ourselves some beer, and we can sit and talk, and hear all about whatever it is that's bothering the Lord Mawat so." Askell sat down beside Mawat. "We've heard rumours, of course, that we knew you'd know what was really going on."
"Did you now?"
"We did," asserted Arkim.
"And we can just imagine,"
agreed Askell earnestly, "how galling it must be to know that your rightful inheritance has been denied you, and for what? No, we've come entirely out of concern for you, and our desire to know the truth behind these recent, very alarming rumours." Without waiting to hear him say any more, you turned and walked away from them, across the square and down to the water, where you pulled your cloak around yourself and sat down on the sand watching the waves and the boats as they went in and out of the harbour across the strait. You did not turn your head toward the tower, though I am quite certain you were thinking of it, thinking of standing atop it, of Radihor reading off the messages the tokens formed, of that second stairwell, of passing Askell and Arkim on your way down the stairs, and then seeing them again so soon after, talking to Mawat in the square. When the water was dazzling with the light of the setting sun, too bright to look at any longer, you closed your eyes and muttered, "Surely they're gone by now." Still you sat, until the sun had set and the sky began to grow dark. Then you rose and brushed the sand off your trousers and your cloak, and trudged across the beach, back up into the town. Not three steps into the shadow of the fortress wall, someone grabbed your arm. You spun, bringing up your other arm, and your fist met your assailant's face and your knee his stomach. He'd let go of you and doubled over, gasping, the knife he'd held fallen clattering to the stones of the street. You reached for your own knife, and someone swore your assailant was not alone, and dived at you, slamming you up against a nearby building. The second assailant gave a cry of pain as the blade of your knife glanced off his ribs and your knee landed solidly in his crotch, but still he held you pinned to the wall. By now the first assailants had straightened, and he cried out, "Raven, take you!" and swung his fist at your face. Farther down the street a voice called out,
"Hey there! What are you doing?"
And your first assailant's fist, weighted with a heavy gold ring, met your face. The back of your head met the wall, and you collapsed unconscious. I don't think I could blame you if you resented Askell and Arkim. They did, after all, try to kill you. But can you imagine what it was like for them? Mawat, in a temper, might sulk, sometimes quite dramatically. But Askell and Arkim, should they not have been grateful just to be alive? What business did they have complaining about anything, being angry or indignant about anything? Who around them would fail to remind them of this at the least sign of resentment? Who protected them, comforted them, spoke up for them? Oh, they were housed and fed and clothed, taught reading and figuring, learned riding and arms alongside the lease's heir. But they were so often reminded in large and small ways that they did not deserve any of it. And if, as was sometimes whispered, some resident of the fortress had gotten or borne them, that person did not ever own them in public or speak up for them. They learned early not to rely on anyone but each other for anything beyond the bare necessities of life. And for this, for their exclusive reliance on each other, and for their obvious efforts to conceal their reactions to the many large and small insults they faced, they were often called, in private or to their faces, scheming or conniving. It was proof, some said, that they didn't truly belong there, or anywhere, that they were indelibly marked by the cursed circumstances of their birth. Small wonder if they grew up angry and resentful. Small wonder if they could not entirely conceal it. Perhaps two other children, some other pair of twins rescued from the forest, would have reacted differently to all this, grown up to be people not at all like Askell and Arkim. But they were not some other pair of twins, and I dare say they could be only who they were.
And I think life was better for them after they left for Ardvusktia. Ardvusktians didn't much care how many others had grown in the womb with you, except perhaps as a curiosity. Transplants and visitors from Iraden generally did care, of course, but Askel and Arkim would have been far more able to make their own way in Ardvusktia, to be accepted as just a couple of ordinary men. I doubt they would ever have become paragons of kindness and open honesty, but then, who is? It was, perhaps, not kind to summon them back to Vastai. I think you may have had the experience of someone in authority telling you that you should be content with your lot, and not claim anything more or different from the place and privileges assigned you at birth. That so much had already been given you, and there could be no good reason to wish for anything more or anything less. I suspect that at least in this matter, if not in others, you might have sympathised with the twins. But the fact remains, they did try to kill you. You opened your eyes, or tried. Your left eye was swollen near shut. Blinked, trying, I suppose, to clear your vision or to understand how you had come to be here, and then you winced with a sharp intake of breath. Your face was bruised, your upper lip cut open. I don't doubt you had a headache as well. Do you remember how that had happened? I'm told sometimes a person doesn't remember a blow to the head or the events immediately surrounding it. But surely you remembered leaving the darkening shore and walking into the even darker town. The door opened and Tikaz came in, carrying a basin of water. "Well," she said, "you're awake. That's good. If you'd slept much longer, we'd have started to worry. Don't talk," she admonished, seeing the beginnings of a frown, your indrawn breath as though you were about to speak. She pulled a stool up to the edge of your bed and sat, pulled a cloth out of the basin. "This is just cold spring water. It helps with the bruising." She wrung out the cloth and laid it across your left eye. "But you probably already know that." "What happened?" you asked. Or tried to. Swallowed and tried again. "What happened? How did I get here?" "You were set on in the street," Tikaz told you. "Don't you remember?" "Did you? Did you remember the gold ring on the hand that hit you?"
"I remember, yes. There were two of them. But I don't know how I came here."
"You were carried," Tikaz informed you. "Someone saw you and shouted, and the robbers ran away." Cautiously, you licked your dried lips.
"Was I robbed then?"
"No, they didn't get the chance." She lifted the cloth, rinsed it again in the basin, wrung it, and replaced it on your face.
"Do you think you could sit up? I'll help if you need."
Brusque and businesslike. You sat up mostly on your own and leaned against a pile of cushions, more than had been in your room before.
"My clothes?" you said then. "You said I wasn't robbed."
"And you weren't," agreed Tikaz. "But your shirt was all bloody, and once we had it off you, it seemed like a good idea to just wash all of it." You said nothing.
"And when I say we,"
Tikaz continued into your silence, "I mean me and the landlady's daughter." Your expression did not change, but you closed your eyes and made a short, breathy, "Huh." "Can I ask you a question?" When you did not reply, she plunged ahead as though that were all the permission she needed.
"Are you one of these women who pretends to be a man so she can fight? Or are you actually a man?"
"I'm not a woman," you said, your eyes still closed, as though you didn't want to see her reaction to that.
"Fair enough."
She put a fresh cloth over your eye and said dryly, "There were robbers all over town last night. You weren't their only victim. Askel and Arkim were set upon last night, too.
Arkim has a broken nose and Askel was slashed with a knife. It's a lucky thing the blade didn't end up between his ribs.
It wasn't for want of trying,
you said.
2 against 1, Tikaz observed. And you still almost did for them. I guess they forgot you were a soldier, or they might have discounted you because they thought you were a girl.
You opened your eyes then.
I'm not a girl. And most girls I grew up around knew how to look after themselves. Kind of had to.
I was never more glad than the day they left for Advustia, said Tikaz vehement. They were always saying, my lady this and my lady that, and smirking the whole time, dropping hints about me and Mawat, and staring at me as though I was someone's prize cow.
You said nothing.
I suppose it's not their fault they were born the way they were, she said, voice grudging. But they were always jealous of Mawat.
Is my lord still in the square?
You asked.
Oh, yes, said Tikaz. He saw you carried in last night. I let him know you were all right.
She gave a small, ironic smile. Mostly all right. I'll let him know you're awake when I go.
No one looked after him last night,
you said.
Oh, he was looked after. Never fear, said Tikaz. He has nearly half a dozen blankets now, and people were sneaking in broth and warmed beer until the sun came up.
My lady, you acknowledged. And then, after considering a moment,
what's under the tower?
She looked away, as though you had said something unbearably unseemly. And when the silence stretched out, she asked, voice pointedly casual,
what do you mean?
I was on top of the tower yesterday, lady,
you said.
There was a second stairwell there. But I saw only the one set of stairs on the entrance level and only one in the room where the bench is. Where does that other stair go?
What's under the tower?
You're not supposed to ask that question, said Tikaz, frowning.
Your pardon, lady,
you said, your voice very, very polite and very tired.
I am asking it.
Only certain people get to go up there, said Tikaz. I've never been up there.
Your father, you suggested.
Do all the directions go there?
What about the mother of the silent?
Oh, yes, she's been up there, agreed Tikaz. But she doesn't go
down those other stairs. Only the Lys can do that.
But what's down there, lady, you insisted.
The bones of all the previous Lyses,
she told you, still frowning.
The Lys goes down there every day to do something.
Anyone else who goes doesn't come back up. That's what they say.
Bones? You repeated, disbelieving.
I heard my father say,
she said quietly, almost a whisper,
that there are weapons down there, captured in Advustia during the war.
What sort of weapons?
You asked.
I don't know,
Tikaz admitted. I suppose they're there to keep them from ever being used against Iradin. You thought about that a moment. Servants can go up on the top of the tower, can't they? I don't think the Lys carries everything up there every day that he needs.
Oh, well, servants, of course, said Tikaz. But they don't go under the tower. I don't understand why you're asking this.
You stopped.
When they searched for the Lord Mawat's father, did they look under the tower?
It was a part of why they were so quick to confirm Hibal as Lys, said Tikaz.
Actually, because then he could search there. No one else could go down there, and Mawat was still days away.
So, we only have the Lord Hibal's word for it then, that Mawat's father wasn't there?
Why would he be?
Asked Tikaz. Why would he have gone down under the tower and not come back up?
unless something happened to him, some sort of accident or...
She stopped. No, the Lys doesn't die until he sacrifices himself for the instrument. No accidents, no getting sick, not sick enough to die. And anyone who tries to kill the Lys just dies. It's happened before.
So, maybe the Lord, he bowed, did something?
You almost shook your head in puzzlement, then thought better of it.
Took him captive and hid him somewhere? Under the tower, maybe?
My Lord is certain that his father didn't flee, that he'll have found some way to die for the raven no matter what. But what exactly happened? And why did the Lord Hebal rush for the bench the way he did before my Lord could get here?
Tikaz crossed her arms.
There's no question Hebal was far too eager to take Mawat's place. Hebal has always been jealous of his brother. I'm sure he had something to do with Elise's disappearance. I just don't see how.
Lady, you said, respectfully, what does your father think?
Tika snorted.
He wouldn't tell me.
I think you tried to give her a sceptical look, but it was difficult to be sure under the bruising.
Tikaz made an exasperated noise.
You know Mawat, said Tikaz. You've seen how he is. He can be generous and kind, it's true, and he can hold his temper well enough when he needs to, when he thinks he needs to.
You did not reply to this, not to agree, not to argue.
But cross him, and you'll regret it, continued Tikaz. Oh, you've been careful never to cross him, I'm sure. Or at least you know how far you can go with him. I have no doubt of it. Mawat's father was much the same, only worse. As Lys, there were very few occasions on which he needed to hold his temper. As far as he was concerned, he was the ruler of Vastai, and it was treason to contradict him or deny anything he wished.
The Lys is supposed to have whatever he desires, you pointed out.
It's his right. He's sacrificing his life for Iriden.
That's easy to say when you're safely far away from Vastai. And the Lys is supposed to govern Iriden along with the Council of the Directions.
My father...
She frowned, more than she had already been frowning.
This is not for anyone's ears outside this room.
My lady,
you acknowledged...
My father felt that the last Lys had abandoned all his responsibilities to Iriden and cared only for the gratification of his own desires. And so, when Hebal came to my father, and yes, Hebal did come to him, promising to truly serve Iriden and the raven if only he could take the bench instead of Mawat.
My father listened.
Because Mawat is so much like his father?
You guessed.
And the Lord Hebal had already shown an interest in actually governing Iriden.
Tikaz gave a bitter laugh.
And besides that, Hebal would support my father on some matters that the directions have been debating.
But was the Lord Mawat's father already missing when the Lord Hebal came to your father?
You asked.
Yes, said Tikaz. A servant from the tower. It came to my father in a panic because the instrument had been found dead. But no one knew where the Lys was. The servant had seen the Lys just a few hours before, atop the tower alone. The Lys had been there all day and would not see anyone. He threatened the servant for coming up and told him it would be worth his life to intrude on the Lys's privacy again. But the servant knew well enough that his life would be equally in danger if he did not tend to the Lys's needs. So after a few hours, he returned with some supper and a warmer cloak. When he came up the steps, he saw the instrument lying dead, and no one else. The tower was searched, and all the servants and guards questioned, but the Lys was nowhere to be found.
My father left with the servant to search the tower again. By the time he came back, it was quite late. Our servants had all gone to bed, but I had stayed up or tried to. There is an alcove by the door with a seat where I waited for my father, but I fell asleep and only woke when he and Hibal were in the room talking. They must not have seen me there, or they would never have spoken so freely. And I didn't hear everything they said. They went into my father's chamber and closed the door. But I heard enough. The instrument was dead. The list was nowhere to be found, and my father was being urged to help put Hibal on the bench before Mawat could arrive to claim it and prove too much like his father. They still will have had to convince Mother Zejume, of course, but I didn't hear how they planned to do that. So they searched the whole tower, you said, except the part underneath, because only the least can go there. Or is it that only the least can go down there and come out alive? Tikaz didn't say anything to that. But Hibao, who we're agreed most likely had something to do with Elise's disappearance, even if we can't figure out what it was, Hibao, once he was confirmed as Lise, could go down below and come up to report that his brother wasn't there. His brother, who had disappeared mysteriously, whose position Hibal was known to have wanted, and whose heir he actively schemed to displace. Hibal looked and tells us there was nothing there. And we are to believe him? Oh, I don't believe him, said Tikas. He's as bad as his brother, only he has had to hide his temper. No, I don't believe anything he says, but I don't see how it makes a difference. Once he sat on the bench, everything else was irrelevant. He's the Raven's Lease now. I still don't... you began. Tikaz watched you, silent. If you're right... you fell silent again. If Hibao was sincere about preventing Mawat from taking the bench because he might be too much like his father, then he and the Lord Radihor must have no intention of allowing the Lord Mawat to remain heir. I never heard my father say that, said Tikaz. You scoffed. Just the quietest huff of disbelief. He would not need to say it, lady. So, my questions are not irrelevant to everyone here. They are relevant to Mawat, Tikaz agreed. But for everyone else, do you think it makes a difference to most of us, whether the Lise is Hibal or Mawat? It clearly doesn't matter to the Raven, or he'd have done something about it. You shook your head and then winced, clearly regretting it. I don't understand it. And why should Hibal want it so badly if it comes to that? And then, after some more thought, could the Zulans have helped Hibal do this? I think they expected him to let them cross the strait. Now he isn't letting them, and they're making noises about supporting a revolt to put Mawat on the bench. They are what? Tikaz, surprised. Shocked. That's not how it works. Only the Raven can put someone on the bench. Maybe they don't know that, you suggested. That snake. I think the Zulans have brought a god to Vastai. And maybe that god helped Hibal get rid of the lease at the right time to be able to take his place. But the Raven would never allow that, protested Tikaz. There was a knock at the door. Tikaz hastened to pull your blankets up closer to your shoulders as she called out, "Who is it?"
"A messenger from the lease,"
came the reply. Tikaz rose and, after looking to you for assent, opened the door. A man stood there in the black overshirt of a tower servant. He bowed and said to Tikaz,
"Lady, the Raven's Lease has sent to me to inquire about the good Aeolo's health, having heard he was set upon last night."
Tikaz stood aside and waved a hand in your direction. "Here is the good Aeolo." And turning to you, "How is your health, sir?"
"As well as can be expected, I suppose,"
you said.
"I am flattered by the Lise's interest in my humble self. Please thank him for me." "As to that,"
said the servant, looking nervously at Tikaz, and then at you again. He stopped and grimaced.
As to that, my lord the lease was concerned that his heir, who ought to be looking out for you, was currently distracted with other matters. Has there been a doctor to see to you, sir? I see that you are conscious, which will hearten my lord the lease considerably. Is there any difficulty of vision or speech, any paralysis? These are dangers that may come on suddenly, some time after a blow to the head.
There was a doctor here last night, sir, said Tikaz, with a smile, her voice uncharacteristically sweet. And he will be here again today to check on just those things.
Very good, lady. Very good, said the servant, still awkward, looking around the room as though suspecting someone else might be there, or as though he feared to be overheard. The Raven's Lease will be happy to provide any medicines or treatment you may require, sir, seeing, as I said, the Lord Mowat would appear to be otherwise occupied.
I understand you, you replied. I've been knocked on the head before, and I know a dangerous injury when I see one. I think I'll be fine, though I do have a headache.
That's only to be expected, said Tikaz, still sweetly.
The lease did offer a tincture, said the servant, one he uses himself when he has the headache, or really any other pain. It's very effective, and he would be happy to send you some.
I don't think I'll need it, sir, you said. But do thank the lease for me.
Of course,
the servant said, and looked around again, from you to Tikaz and back, and then seemed to make up his mind about a thing.
If you will excuse us, lady, there are some questions I must ask of a medical nature. If I and this gentleman could have some privacy.
Tikaz put one hand on her hip and gave the servant a disbelieving look.
A medical nature? I've been tending to this gentleman all this time. No, it's all right, you said,
and after another scathing look at you this time, she left the room and closed the door behind her.
Good sir, said the servant when the two of them were alone. I hardly know if I can trust you, but sometimes one has to do a thing because it's one's duty, whatever the result.
It isn't always easy to know what your duty is, you suggested.
It isn't,
the servant agreed, still standing, stiff and awkward near the door.
But something's wrong. Something's very wrong. And you've served in the field with the Lord Mowat for some time.
A few years,
you agreed. Has that been all right?
He's been kind to me, you said, and generous.
The servant thought about this for a moment, and then said,
I don't know why I'm asking, it hardly matters. Listen, when I tell you this, my life will be in your hands. You understand me?
You want to say something that might be considered disloyal to the lease,
you guessed.
I won't tell. I won't even tell the Lord Mowat.
No, protested the servant. I need you to tell the heir.
He almost seemed near tears, or on the edge of panic.
All right,
you agreed.
I'll tell my lord if you want.
He clasped and unclasped his hands, and then said,
I'm the one who found the raven's instrument dead that day. An old dead bird stretched out on the ground. You'd hardly think it had been a god.
He hesitated.
Its neck had been wrung. Its neck had been wrung, and the lease was nowhere to be seen, though I'd left him there hours before, and he hadn't come down the stairs. No one had, I'm sure of that. I searched. There was no one there, and nowhere he could have gone.
He could have gone under the tower, you suggested.
And the servant's brown face paled a bit and took on just the slightest greenish tinge.
Listen, sir, listen. If I take too long at this errand, he might suspect. Listen, I went and got the Lord Radihor, and he came, and we searched again and found nothing. And it was decided
It was decided to confirm the Lord Hebal as Lys. I hardly know how, but that's not my business. I serve in the tower. I serve the Lys, and he's been easier to deal with than his brother. You understand me?
Yes.
You did not move. Under the blankets, just watched him steadily as he spoke. The servant nodded. Yes, you understand what I mean. It's easier. But the other day, I was on top of the tower, cleaning, laying things out, keeping an eye on the egg, you know, cleaning up yesterday's offering, getting ready for the next, and I was standing near the top of the stairs, those other stairs. You tensed then, but did not move.
And?
And I heard something. Nothing further. He just stood there watching you, wringing his hands, waiting for your reaction. You took a moment, I think, to compose yourself.
What did you hear?
Screaming, the servant said. I heard screaming, and I swear to you it was the raven's Lys. It was his voice, the last one I mean, the Lord Mawat's father, somewhere at the bottom of those steps, screaming, help me, murder, treason. He took a shaking breath and swallowed, unclasped his hands, and resolutely placed them at his sides. There's something very wrong, he said, and I think the Lord Mawat needs to hear about it. When the gods who had entered the trading agreements with the gods of Ardvuskdia decided to join the war against Iriden, I was not obliged to come along. I had never been a party to any such agreement and had no obligations to fulfil, no promises to keep. Still, I went south to Ardvuskdia. A god of Iriden had attacked me and harmed the people who had camped in my shadow, who had been under my protection. The fact that I had only belatedly realised that those people were under my protection changed nothing. The fact that I had apparently killed the Iradeni god who had incited the attack also meant little to me. Apparently, the raven had thought it worthwhile to undermine the assembly of the peoples, or perhaps merely to distract Ardvuskdia's potential allies with troubles closer to home. This stratagem had failed, but he might try another. My peaceful and quiet hillside might not remain so, and for once I found I was not indifferent to this fact. And besides, the myriad was going, and she was my friend. Getting to Ardvuskdia was not easy for me. Many of the other northern gods could travel quite easily by running, by flying, or even just wishing to be where they wanted to go. Though, as I've already mentioned, that's a risky method if conditions are not precisely as you require or expect. I did not have legs to walk or run with, and I could fly only with the expenditure of a great deal of power. I was still recovering from the attack on the camp, and I would help no one if I exhausted myself entirely in the effort to reach Ardvuskdia.
It would be a great deal easier, the myriad said to me, if you would take a different body.
No doubt, I agreed, but I do not want a different body.
It wouldn't need to be permanent,
the myriad said, unwilling to give up the argument. Below us, people laid out the huge rollers that would help move me south. Thick, smooth tree trunks that had reached my hillside only with great difficulty and outrageous expense, wood still being scarce. All around me, people were digging, loosening the hillside's hold on me. They worked with a will. They had not forgotten the attack or the earlier slaughter at the river camp.
We could find you something to travel in. And there is no shortage of large stones in Ardvuskdia. You would almost certainly have a variety to choose from. I'm sure you'd find something comfortable for you.
I don't want another stone, I said. Have you abandoned your own that fell from the heavens?
I was about to mention that, in fact, said the myriad.
I am not always in that stone, or more properly its fragments, but I find I'm still connected to them. I can be within them quite easily when I wish. If you left this stone on this hillside, you would in all likelihood not be abandoning it, but leaving it temporarily, and could be back within it at your desire.
I am sure you're right since you say it, I replied, but I have been this stone for a very long time, and I have no desire to be anything else. I believe travelling this way will be more convenient for me.
But not more convenient for anyone else, protested the myriad. It would be far more convenient for the rest of us, not to mention for the people building your transport and digging you out of the ground, if you took my advice.
No doubt, I agreed, and did not argue further, but neither did I change my plans. The myriad was a good friend and a wise one, but I can be very stubborn. The myriad travelled with me, a whole cloud of her, flying alongside or resting atop me as I rolled along. It was difficult at first, but the nearer I came to Ardvulkdia, the wider and smoother the roads became, until I rolled easily along with only a bit of assistance from my own power. The air grew warmer, the plants grew taller and greener and more lush as we went along, and I thought of what the myriad had told me about the world beyond my hillside, the way it was warmer to the south, and while days grew shorter in the winter, there were no times when the sun did not rise at all, nor days in the summer when it did not set. I mentioned this to the myriad, and we talked about why that might be. We passed woods and meadows, quite a few villages, and eventually, as we grew closer to Ardvulkdia, the occasional tumble-down building amid barren, weed-filled fields. But as we went on, we saw fewer trees and plants, and no people at all, until the landscape alongside the road was bare dirt, with here and there a half-fallen building, or even a collection of them.
"We are very near Ardvulkdia now," said the myriad. "But when I was here last, these were villages and woods and fields planted with barley and other things humans eat, and there were people working in the fields."
"I don't see anything growing here," I said. "What has happened? Has the Raven of Iriden done this?"
"I don't think so," said the myriad. "Well, not directly at any rate, but I suppose we'll find out what happened here when we reach the city."
And so we did. Or I suppose I should say we found out when we reached the walls of Ardvulkdia, because I was not certain I could fit comfortably through the gate, and so I rolled off the road and sat in the dirt beside the wall, while the myriad went in to tell her friends and acquaintances that we had arrived. I sat for a while, watching the wispy clouds drifting across the blue sky, and examining the stones of the city walls. Huge white stone blocks that seemed to be made entirely of millions of small, ridged cylinders and tiny hole discs crammed together along with the occasional small bivalve shell. It took me some time and thinking to realise that the cylinders and discs were fragments of crinoid stems, and I was looking at limestone that had once been a seabed. Ardvulkdia sat at the edge of the sea, I had been told, but I had seen no sign of any sea nearby. I had also been told that Ardvulkdia was full of people, fuller of people even than the camp of the Assembly of the Peoples, which I had never seen. But I saw no one while I sat beside the city's wall, near one of its gates. All was silence, except for the wind, and when I listened closely, the occasional cry of a gull. So there was water relatively nearby at any rate. As I sat pondering this, I began to wonder if I had not made a mistake in coming here, or not coming here in a way that would have allowed me to easily return to my hillside. But there was no simple remedy for such a mistake, if mistake I had made, and so I sat there, atop my raft of timber rolls in the dirt beside the wall. Eventually, a god came out of the city to meet me.
a small, skinny brown dog of the sort I learned later, bred and trained by farmers in the Ardvustian countryside to help herd sheep. He spoke several languages, it turned out, one of which was familiar to me. He sat on his haunches in the dirt in front of me, scratched one ear with a hind leg, and then introduced himself as Oisin.
"And you, I take it, are the strength and patience of the hill."
"So I am called," I replied.
"Welcome,"
he said, and began to speak to me of Ardvustia. Behind the wall, he told me, was a city of multi-story brick and stone buildings, hard up against each other, and flagstone streets and convoluted gravel-paved alleys. What had been a small settlement had expanded past its walls twice, leaving the foundations of those old ramparts to decay in favour of building the latest boundary, and swallowing three other nearby villages in the process. This expansion, and the need for defensive walls, was due to Ardvustia's broad, key-lined harbour. The harbour is much the same now as when I first saw it, though at that time the Raven Tower of Vastai, along with most of the fortress, had not yet been built, so the view across the strait from one of Ardvustia's keys would have been somewhat different. In any event, Oisin, the small brown dog, explained to me that a city like Ardvustia had a great many people who require food, but very little space in which to grow that food, no space for any significant herding, and very little opportunity for hunting. The surrounding farmland had once supplied some of that food, but as I would have already seen, nothing grew there now. "Because of the war," Oisin said, without specifying further. In any event, even so, not all of Ardvustia's food had come from the countryside. Ardvustia was also fed from the sea. But the war with Iriden had cut off a great deal of that supply as well. Ships no longer came through the strait in any great number, because it was no longer safe. Even fishing had grown chancy. Ardvustia, in short, was in dire need of food. And Oisin, an old and revered god of the city, who specialised in healing, had thought of a way to provide it.
"Food," Oisin said to me, "is, among other things, fuel for animals. From all I can discover, animal bodies. I suppose I should say they extract needed substances from suitable food and use those substances, or reassemble them into other necessary substances. If we can find those substances or make them, then we can make food directly, without waiting for it to grow. When first I tried it, making suitable food from things humans couldn't eat cost me a great deal of effort. It was hardly worth doing, really, except for the fact that it was so much faster than waiting for barley to grow. But over time, I've learned more about how and why it works, and I've been able to make my statements more specific." He cocked his head to look at me. The whole thing seemed very strange to me at first. I was not used to thinking of grain as being made up of the things one finds in dirt or air. And yet, that would appear to be the case.
"You make food out of dirt and air?"
I asked. "A kind of food, yes," agreed Oisin. "It's not easy. Supplying a city with food requires a steady, constant effort. I can do it myself for short periods of time, but I cannot do it alone as constantly as it needs to be done. And lives depend on it. I would welcome assistance. The other gods here are either too busy with other urgent matters or else fundamentally unsuited to the task. That is to say, they can say the necessary words, but they do not entirely understand them and make mistakes that cost them strength or that jeopardise the wholesomeness of the results. The myriad suggested to me that you would do well with it."
"I have been thinking," I said, "about the power we use to make things happen. It seems to me that when I make something happen by speaking, the amount of power I use might well be the same as the amount of—" I was not sure what to call it.
the amount of effort or strength it would take to do it by other means. Lifting a heavy object, for instance. The means and costs of lifting heavy objects had, of course, been much on my mind in recent weeks. But there are ways to make lifting things much easier. The levers, for instance, or ramps and wheels, and it's correspondingly easier to speak such mechanisms into work.
Yes, 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 barked Oisin. I do believe the myriad was right. Such a relief. The other gods here who understand this are all preoccupied with weapons.
I think that everything that happens requires some sort of force or power to happen, I said. And when it comes to lifting things, I believe I can see what that power might be.
You can see it in action, at least, remarked Oisin. You can see muscles lift and strain. The power that allows those muscles to move, the fuel of it, is in food.
But what force made the food grow? I asked. Do you know? If you must spend power to combine dirt and air and other things into that fuel, what is the power that does it without your help?
Such an interesting question, barked Oisin.
I look forward to discussing it with you, but I have one doubt remaining. The myriad tells me you were recently drained of a good deal of your power and are still recovering. Did she also tell you that I am annoyingly stubborn?
She did,
acknowledged Oisin, tail thumping on the ground. I think that will be helpful to you in this, but I warn you, there are not prayers enough to go around here, nor other offerings, nor do we have anyone we can spare for human sacrifice. Oh, the people of this city make near constant prayers and offerings, but there are only so many of them, and most of those offerings are spoken for. Do you have the strength to undertake this as you are, in such conditions?
I thought about that. I thought about the way it seemed nothing could happen without power of some sort, including plants growing.
Thought about the long, dark winters on my hillside when nothing grew, and at most plants waited, still and hidden, for the sun to return and warmth. Thought of the way that the air had warmed as I'd travelled south, and plants had seemed greener and larger. I thought also of wheels and the things the myriad had said about the sun and the stones that circled it, and the stars that moved across the sky. While I was thinking, the sun set and rose again.
I've been thinking, I said to Oisin when he returned the next afternoon.
Yes, the myriad had warned me you might do that.
I think I can do it, I said, but I will need at least one person, three or four would be better if so many are available, to make regular offerings, and to help spin me around. I think that as long as I'm turning, I'll be able to make food for you.
And maybe not just food, but I wasn't certain about that part, and so I did not mention it.
Oisin considered this for a few moments. I'll do my best to find some people for you, he said at last, though I may only be able to provide one or two at the most. I can probably find a larger crew on a very temporary basis to set you up so you can be turned more easily. Wouldn't be practical to try it with you flat on the ground as you are.
No, I agreed. I didn't think so. I have some ideas about how to do that.
I am not surprised, he said. And while that is being made ready, you can tell me why you think spinning will do anything at all.
I think it may be difficult to explain, I admitted. I am not entirely certain it will do anything.
I'm very interested in your thoughts, nonetheless, said Oisin, and I'm very glad you've come to Ardvustia. But first, let me explain the process.
Have you ever thought about where food comes from? You grew up on a farm, so of course on one level you must have been aware that food comes from somewhere, from almost the beginning of your being aware of anything. But beyond that, beyond... Food comes from the right plants and from animals who eat those plants. I had never thought much about it. It had seemed merely an obvious fact of the world, like the sun and the sky, and the way things fell downward if nothing held them up. But even these supposedly simple and obvious facts are more complex than it might seem. And as I sat listening to Oisin, I discovered that food was also. Not every animal eats plants, Oisin told me, but every animal eats either plants or things that eat plants. Different sorts of plants contain various substances according to their nature, but there is one thing all plants have in common. Somehow given air and sunlight, they make a substance that is a basic fuel that animals need to live and move. There is at least one other substance also that humans must have in their food, or they eventually die, but I do not yet entirely understand why. This also, I believe, plants somehow make, using only sunlight, air and water. "Are you suggesting," I asked, "that one requires only sunlight, air and water to make food for humans? What about soil? Most plants I know of must have soil to grow."
"Yes, and there are other things plants take from the soil, but I don't fully understand why or what their role might be in food. If only I had the luxury of investigating this as I would like. I specialise in healing and in maintaining health, and so this topic has long been of interest to me, but ever since Vastai attacked us, I have, from necessity, focused on the problem of pure survival, of providing enough food, in addition to healing sickness and injury, and have not been able to investigate the details of how food works as completely as I'd like to. He went on to explain his ideas about air and water, and what the essential substances of food might be, and what plants might be doing to turn air and water into these substances so essential to human life. And he named for me the series of statements he thought the most efficient for producing them. If you just say, this air and water have become a quart of barley, Oisin cautioned me, there is no predicting just how that will happen, and there's how much power it'll cost you. I don't advise attempting it. The results may very well be fatal to you, but if you say, this air and water will combine as they do in plants to make sugar and protein, these were the words that he was using for those first two substances he had determined to be essential to human food. That is far more specific. The range of possible actions is limited, and one can predict the cost of saying so much more reliably. In fact, the actual statement I use is far more specific even than that. You should try it on a small scale first. I advise being very specific about the location and volume of the air and water concerned, and where and when the resulting food will appear. While he was speaking, a person in a light woven tunic and trousers came out of the city gate with a bucket of water and an empty bowl of unfired, unpainted clay. She set them beside Oisin and stepped back, waiting. "Here is some water," said Oisin, "and here is a bowl for the resulting food. I don't think it matters what air you use, so long as it's nearby." I thought for a while. Eventually Oisin wandered back into the city, and more humans in tunics and trousers came out and measured me, and then stood talking and pointing to the ground near me, sometimes sketching out shapes in the dirt with their feet or their fingers, watching me speculatively as they worked, talking to each other as they eyed me. I did not understand what they said. The person who had brought the bucket and the bowl did not leave, but crouched down beside them, waiting. In the depth of the night, moonless, the stars moving slowly in the sky overhead, I spoke, and suddenly a coarse powder sat in the bottom of the bowl. The person who still sat beside it took some between her fingers and put it in her mouth. Then she gave a small, bitter-seeming smile
and said something to me that I did not understand, and picked up the bowl and went into the city. The Aardvurkdians built me a platform, right there outside the city wall, on top of which was an ingenious arrangement of rollers and wheels. Once I was placed atop this, with the help of ropes, rollers and ramps, I could spin, slowly, with a relatively few people pushing. At first, 8 were assigned to me, but that dropped to 4 once I had suggested some changes to the mechanism on which I sat. They turned me, slowly, from morning till night, rain or shine, their muscles straining, their bare feet dusty or sinking into mud. Every few hours, a full vat of grainy powder would be wheeled away and a new empty one put in its place. Sometimes the people pushing me were grim and silent, or they wept, especially when their hands blistered, which happened frequently at first, until they became more accustomed to the work, and I learned to prevent it. Sometimes they chattered and laughed, though nearly always with a bitter edge to their laughter. I began to learn a bit of the language they spoke. The myriad came occasionally to check on me and pass on news and gossip, and I learned more of the language with her assistance. Gods in the north did not have attendants as such. Anyone might approach a god directly at any time. Well, approaching the drowned one could be difficult, but in principle there was no need for specially appointed or trained attendants to help direct one's interaction with the god. The people I have been calling priests were people who had more experience than usual dealing with gods, and perhaps detailed knowledge about one or more gods. They had acquired their knowledge and experience through specialized training or perhaps just circumstance. People would come to a priest for assistance or advice if they felt they needed it, or if the god in question required more care than usual, like the drowned one, or was difficult to communicate with, as I was reputed to be. But the assistance of a priest was not required, and was not always sought. But the gods of Aardvurkdia, the largest, most powerful ones, had whole staffs, assistants and agents, priests, servants to obtain or care for sacrificial animals. If a person needed or wanted something from, say, the god who had once specialized in the napping of flint, but who had lately expanded into metallurgy, if you wanted something from that god, you would not ask directly, no. You would approach a secretary, one of dozens. Eventually you might receive an answer of some sort. All the most powerful gods of Aardvurkdia had such staffs, including Oisin. I had no establishment, never did, but here, daily, constantly, these 4 people turned me at my request. Their steady movement around and around me was satisfying, in a small way, to be sure, but in a way that reminded me of my satisfaction with the apparent motions of the moon and the stars. And I began to be interested in the details of human lives, in a way I mostly had not been before, or at least interested in these particular human lives. One woman lacked part of her left arm, but pushed with a will for all that. Another walked with a pronounced limp, and had to take more frequent breaks than the others, which none of us begrudged her. The other 2 of my attendants were quite young, 2 adolescent girls, inseparable companions, in fact. One joked and smiled quite a lot, but the other spoke rarely and quietly, and would not look at the person she was speaking to, but she sometimes spoke with a wry, unexpected sense of humour. She also had a fascination with rocks, had been visibly excited to see me, and on breaks would wander nearby, poking into the bare dirt or mud with her hands or feet, digging up what stones she found. She particularly liked ones with impressions of seashells or bits of sparkling quartz. She was the sort of person who tends to become a priest in the north, and I began to think of her as a priest, even though no Aardvurkdian would have considered her one. In fact, I discovered as I listened that all 4 of my attendants were slaves,
owned by Oysen's establishment. None of them offered me prayers. Oysen had led them to believe that I was not a god, but a god-spoken stone, and they had been instructed to turn me as part of a rite to Oysen himself. They had been given a series of prayers to make Oysen as they worked. What prayers I received came from somewhere else, from, I was sure, among Oysen's most trusted attendants, ones who could be relied on to conceal the fact that I was indeed a god. I found I resented this, resented Oysen's attempt at deception, and resented his co-opting my attendants for his own profit. But I did not say anything about it. I was plainly not meant to know.